Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the March 11th, 2012 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the things I'd like to talk about with you today. First, Japan, 1 year after the earthquake and tsunami that killed thousands, in some counts I saw 19,000 or more people. Should Japan reduce its reliance on nuclear power, which is one suggestion that I saw in a retrospective article today. Next, why you should not rely on the Wall Street Journal, especially not the headlines, for news on the Israeli, quote-unquote, Palestinian conflict. We'll discuss the substance of the story as well, not just the coverage. Third, the Justice Department threatens to sue Apple and also some book publishers about their pricing of ebooks and more stories as well. Those of you who are attending live are invited to call in, talk with me about these topics. The phone number is 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. Also, if you're sitting there in the chat room, you can type questions and comments as well. We try to keep up with those, too. Before we jump into discussing the Japan anniversary of the earthquake and tsunami, a couple of things. I had one comment on my blog in reaction to my question, have you reset your clocks? And I'm saying, judging by the number of people in the chat room, maybe some people haven't reset their clocks. Although it's funny because now the devices are so automated, our cell phones, our computers, they reset themselves. Yeah. And in fact, it was funny because the Blog Talk Radio engine, whatever it is, I didn't realize it had done this, but it was anticipating the time change in the last couple of weeks. And so my shows had been shown as being scheduled for 4 p.m. Right. Pacific time. And I had to go in and manually switch them to 5 p.m. and say, why are they doing this? I should have left them the way they are, because then today I had to switch it all back again. I don't trust the computers, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, so John Kenny in my blog, he says, well, should we, in honor of daylight saving time, just discuss the idea that is a broken clock right twice a day? So if you haven't reset your clock, then maybe it's still correct. Twice, no, not actually. It has to be a broken clock. So it has nothing to do with the resetting. No. Why did John Kenny bring this up? I have no idea. he sucked me into it too. Of course, a broken clock is not correct twice a day because it's not actually registering anything. It's just happened to be displaying certain numbers on it.
If you know it's broken and you look up at it, at the exact point that it's the correct time, sure. Besides that,
it's this whole issue of can it actually be right?
I know.
So if a parrot,
it's dead wrong.
If a parrot recites 2 + 2 = 4, is it evidencing any cognition or is it just reciting some sounds?
Right.
And of course, it's reciting some sounds just like a clock is displaying some numbers. In fact, clocks all the time are just displaying numbers.
Absolutely.
So are they actually right or are they just mechanisms displaying things? This is our philosophy tangent for today.
I can't say how many times I look at the time and it's 9/11. I'm not joking. It always happens.
That's always bad. Anyway. That's because of the work that you do too.
I think
you're going to notice it more than most people. The other little thing I want to talk about was Kira Peikoff's book signing. I attended her book signing yesterday in the city of Orange. There is a bookstore called Book Carnival. Book Carnival in Orange, and it looks like a nice little shop. And I think they're focused on mysteries and thrillers and stuff. So it's an independent bookstore right up Kira's alley.
And they did have a few comics on the desk though, which is pretty cool.
It was good for Bosch to be able to look at a couple of comics, a couple of decently drawn comics as well. there was a good turnout, I thought, yeah. And Kira gave a little talk, and then she took some questions, and there were good questions from the audience, and people seemed enthusiastic. A lot of people got in line to get their book signed, including me, so now I have my hard copy of the book signed as well. For those of you who missed it, last week I did an interview with Kira and talked to her about her recently released thriller, Living Proof. If you missed that, of course, go check out the interview. And you can also, if you'd like to go to some of her upcoming appearances, check out her own website. It's kirapeikoff.com, K-I-R-A-P-E-I-K-O-F-F.com. And all of her upcoming appearances are listed there. I understand that she is in San Francisco, and she's planning on being at a bookstore called The Booksmith tomorrow at 7:30 to do another book signing. So I recommend going. It's a definitely pleasant experience. And
Monday, 7:30. Monday.
Yeah, Monday at 7:30. So that'll be March 12th at 7:30.
Yeah, exactly.
So those of you in the San Francisco area, go check her out. Okay, so the year anniversary. Did it seem like a year since?
Absolutely not. I just can't believe it.
I was kind of surprised, too, that a whole year has passed since Japan suffered the earthquake and then the tsunami.
I remember that night watching the video. It was a year ago.
Yeah.
It was on Fox News late night.
And we discussed it quite a bit on this show as well, because this show was up in full swing, and we had
actually listened to the episodes via maybe your blog.
Oh, yeah. People could still go to my blog at don'tletitgo.com and listen to the episodes where we were discussing. And I actually think it's valuable to go back and listen to some of that, especially in light of a story that I read today. I got some news today off the Washington Times, and we'll talk more later about why I went to the Washington Times to get some news, because I was disappointed by the Wall Street Journal. So I pulled up a story on the anniversary, and it says Japan marks anniversary of quake and tsunami. And they had ceremonies and such there in Japan. And a lot of these stories talk about individuals and their particular stories. So someone whose sister is still missing and she feels like she can't put things behind her until they actually find the body. And horrible, heart-wrenching individual stories about people who suffered. But then there's also a discussion about what Japan is doing as a whole in terms of the rebuilding process, and what lessons they think that they are learning from this. And it's the second in particular that I wanted to talk about. So there's one comment that I did want to talk about with respect to the rebuilding, though. And it's Prime Minister, and I'm going to probably really mess up the name. You want to help me with this name here, Bosch?
Yoshihiko Noda.
Yoshihiko Noda. Noda, I think, is easy enough. I probably still didn't pronounce it correctly, but it's N-O-D-A. You think you couldn't?
Like Yoda, Noda, probably.
Maybe, possibly, perhaps. He reminded the Japanese people that they have overcome many disasters and difficulties in the past, and he pledged to rebuild the nation so it will be, quote, reborn as an even better place, end quote. And the article here from the Washington Times talks about the struggle to do this rebuilding in light of the fact that they, too, like every other country in the world, has a huge national debt. They have a huge national debt. And it says they have an economy that has been stagnant for two decades.
Right.
It's very hard to rebuild from natural disasters of this magnitude when you've got those struggles. But, you know, Mr. Noda, he is confident they're going to be able to get through this as well. He says, our predecessors who brought prosperity to Japan have repeatedly risen up from crises, every time becoming stronger. So he's trying to give a motivation. And the promise that he tries to give to them, and I thought this was something worth discussing here, was he says that he pledges, or he hopes, to see the disaster-hit areas fully rebuilt, when, quote, babies born on the day of the disasters turn 10 years old, end quote. So his idea is that all of those vast areas that were destroyed by the tsunami, the earthquake and the tsunami, that they would be rebuilt in a decade.
Wow.
And I was thinking about that in contrast to the obvious example here in the United States, which is 10 years after 9/11, there still was not anything completely rebuilt at this one area, Ground Zero in New York City.
Because of government. because of government.
And so if you think of...
And this is a government official promising...
This is a government official in Japan promising that he thinks... I mean, I think he thinks it's realistic. Of course, he uses the word hope, and I have a thing about the word hope.
Well, the government moves like a slug.
Right, right. But he, you know, that these areas are going to be fully rebuilt in 10 years. Yeah. And we're talking vast areas, tons of destruction. If you go, actually, to... There's a website, boston.com, and they have really nice photography showing you what a particular area looked like right after the disaster, the destruction, and what it looks like now. For the most part, what you see now is just that it's been cleaned up and then a few things have been rebuilt. But if you even just think about the amount of cleanup that was done within 1 year, go to boston.com if you can, find the little retrospective, and they have these huge photos, and then when you click on it, you see what it looked like a year before, and it is really impressive what they've accomplished even in 1 year. I've been very, very impressed.
That's important.
And I feel embarrassed too, because I think of, okay, I'm looking at the cleanup that they've done in a year, and when I think I have a garage to clean out that really needs some help, and it's kind of inspiring what they have been able to do, because the destruction in some of those pictures is just mind-boggling. So go look at that. But the other thing, the most important thing I want to talk about with this is that they have, I don't know, maybe because time passes and they forget exactly what was going on during the disaster, there is now a movement to reduce Japan's dependence on nuclear power. Yeah. Yeah, so and people in the chat room are already talking about this topic, and Bosch is pointing out various of the comments. John in the chat room says, I think I read an article saying that almost all nuclear power plants in Japan are shutting down. John, the article that I have in front of me here does not say that, but it does say that the government is pledging to reduce reliance on nuclear power, which had before the earthquake and tsunami supplied about 30% of the nation's energy. But the government is saying it's going to need to restart some nuclear plants during the transition period, that they can't just go cold turkey and not use this. I think this is terrible. Nuclear is known to be one of the cleanest, safest sources of power ever. But here's this article. And again, I do like the Washington Times and the coverage, and I don't blame the fact that this position is in the article on the Washington Times, but this is, it says public opposition, and they're just reporting this, public opposition to nuclear power has grown in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. And then they say this is the worst disaster since Chernobyl in 1986. There's a different comparison here. Chernobyl just didn't happen to involve an earthquake and tsunami.
Right.
Chernobyl was Russians operating a nuclear plant.
They were rushing to get it right.
Well, ineptly.
Yes.
And this is why
this
you
is
have
a
an accident.
Disaster.
Someone
says that Paul says Alex Epstein was faced with this question during a debate with Greenpeace. He had some great points. Maybe people should check that out.
Definitely.
Also, Robert says, he says, how many deaths due to nature? Thousands. How many due to nuclear reactor malfunction? Zero.
Exactly.
He also says Peter Beckman used to rip on anti-nuke bully Ted Kennedy. More people died at Chappaquiddick than at Three Mile Island. Yeah,
and Three Mile Island was the domestic nuclear accident, but nobody died from that. And if you think of, I think there were a couple of workers that may have died at the Fukushima plant.
Right.
But if you think of the relatively few deaths that occurred from that nuclear plant and the magnitude of the earthquake and the natural disaster that occurred, and it still held up and was relatively safe under all that, I think it shows, and there's a, you know, someone else posting, Derek in the chat room here, is posting a link to a Fox News story that says nuclear power is extremely safe. And this is the discussion that we had a year ago on this show with people who were calling in. Derek almost also in the chat room puts a link to the Greenpeace
debate. Again, like environmentalism, I mean, these Japanese people, are they trying to blame themselves? I mean, with nuclear, because it's man-made, it's created. I mean, whereas nature, they want to stay clear from blaming quote-unquote nature. You know what I mean? They want to stay clear from blaming an earthquake, let's say.
I don't know what's behind this, and I thought all of this was answered a year ago.
Yeah, but they want to just get rid of that and have any pretext. No. Say, we will use this to get rid of nuclear power. That's it.
And people, I don't know, they're not thinking. They're
feeling.
To even compare what happened at Fukushima to Chernobyl is just ridiculous. And with Fukushima, you say, well, look, it took a natural disaster of this magnitude to have, you know, a nuclear power plant be compromised to the extent of Chernobyl. That's how safe Fukushima was. And I don't know, the IAEA was blaming the Japanese government or the people who were supervising the facilities for certain things.
Just trying to shut it down and have the weight of this emotion, you know, against it, with people saying, well, it had to be that, right? That's it.
I would assume, and I guess I'm assuming incorrectly, that the Japanese, of anyone, were so scientifically oriented that they would not be taken in by discussions like this at all, that they would say, look at the true facts, look at the statistics about the safety of nuclear power.
I think people everywhere are the same, and they'll fall for this kind of crap everywhere.
I don't know.
It's a small minority who really has pushed into the youth, probably. Most of these are young people, probably. Most of them.
You know, we have
to speak more clearly, sorry.
No, it's fine. We have so much going on here in the United States that I have not been keeping track of any of the discussion that's going on with Japan, so this is my little revisit. And when I look at this and I say, how are they even going down this path? You would think that they'd have a whole year to be sober about this, look at how well they did in the circumstances, and that they would even be more in favor of nuclear power afterwards. And so, I mean, they don't believe that these types of earthquakes and tsunamis are a way of life.
No.
And maybe, you know, from the Fukushima disaster, you might learn, hey, if we did this little tweak in a design, we can make it even safer. Okay, fine. But I was dumbfounded when I saw this. So I reject it entirely. Everybody needs to go back and review the facts, a lot of which are being posted here in the chat room live, which is great for those of you
who
are here.
But nature didn't build a nuclear plant, so therefore,
Yeah, nature didn't build a nuclear plant. Nature didn't give us penicillin, so we should just all die of infection.
That's
so.
It. No, but it's, you know, they're looking for something to blame and destroy. And again, the anti-nuclear freaks will go out there and push this issue. And they're the only ones who are getting the press. The ones who probably are indifferent to it aren't saying anything.
So Japan, kudos to you for what you've accomplished so far in terms of the cleanup of that horrible disaster. Kudos to you for having the goal of total rebuild within 10 years, because if you can do anything even close to that, you will have beaten us here in the United States. But I hate to say shame on people. I hate to use that, but shame on people who want to destroy the nuclear power industry.
And you know what?
In
these same people, if you spoke to these same people a year ago before this, they probably would have spoken the same song. They were saying the same song. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah,
anti-nuclear.
They're
environmentalists.
They just want to use this incident as a justification. Hi, Derek. You're on. What do you have to add to our discussion here? You posted some very helpful links in the chat room, by the way. Thanks.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
That's my first time calling in. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
I just did some math that I thought you might be interested in. More people die mining coal in China every 6 hours than people have ever died from nuclear power in the history of the Western world.
Oh, my gosh.
Because no one has ever died from a nuclear reactor in the history of the Western world. Three Mile Island and Fukushima both killed zero people.
Wasn't there a worker who died from contamination with Fukushima? I seem to remember there was at least one worker
maybe
who died.
Maybe she was outside the plant and died in the...
No, actually, some people who were physically in the plant died because something fell on them or something. But
so
there
it wasn't
was no...
due to nuclear exposure?
No, no one...
Radiation exposure.
No one in the Western world has ever died from nuclear exposure from a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, only from nuclear bombs, of course. Yes. Yeah.
And if you look at other sources of energy, you know, if this had hit, if the wave had hit a hydro plant or an oil refinery or something, that would have actually killed a lot of people. Like, if I had hit a hydro plant that was near an urban area, that would have been devastating.
Right.
So what this actually proves, like the article I linked in the chat room says, what this actually proves is that nuclear power is safe. That shows how incredibly safe a once-in-a-century tsunami hit a nuclear power plant,
right,
and no one died from nuclear power. So what does that tell us? So people are actually – it's not just that this doesn't say that nuclear power is dangerous. This is actually, I think, an incredible example of showing us how safe and wonderful nuclear power is.
Right.
I was dumbfounded when I saw this article today, and that they are seriously pledging to scale down their use of nuclear power. I mean, is this something that you and Alex have been aware of in terms of Japanese culture being this skeptical of nuclear power?
I don't think it's Japanese culture. I think, you know, Japan is really integrated into Western culture,
mm-hmm,
and environmentalists, which are just, you know, basically a form of anti-industrial leftists.
Right.
Environmentalists are anti-nuclear because they're anti-development.
Yeah.
And that has influenced the Japanese just like it's influenced us. But what are the alternatives? You know, if we cut back on nuclear energy, we're gonna have to mine coal, which kills thousands of people a year, or we could switch to petroleum or something like that. But these are all more dangerous than nuclear, or we can use less energy, but that's the most dangerous option of all. So if you're really concerned with our safety and human well-being, you know, nuclear power is pretty much the way to go.
Isn't it probably also cheaper?
Yeah. Well, it's cheaper when the government doesn't make, you know, businesses go through decades and decades of red tape. But, I mean, the market would decide what's cheaper in an ideal society, and, you know, the cheapest thing would probably be a variety. But yeah, because there's so much energy density in nuclear, it is cheap and it's sustainable and it's safe. I don't think there's any objective reason anyone could oppose it other than, you know, anti-development ideology.
Well, and certainly if they're already struggling financially and their goal is to rebuild completely in 10 years, the last thing they need to do is cripple themselves further by saying that they need to get rid of existing nuclear power plants that would operate just fine and find the energy someplace else at additional cost, right? I mean, they're shooting themselves in the foot as far as I can see.
Yeah, it's just, it's basically the, I think the word radiation scares people, and I think nuclear scares people because of nuclear weapons, but a nuclear power plant isn't any more likely to explode like a nuclear bomb than a banana is. Like, the type of materials that they use in a nuclear power plant is
right.
Just the way it's set up is just completely different. So, you know, nothing could happen to a nuclear power plant to make it explode like a nuclear bomb. And radiation is everywhere. Everything, all material gives out radiation. Bananas give out a lot more radiation than some other things. And the amount of radiation.
I've got some bananas in my kitchen right now, so I'm just thinking of the radiation emanating from them. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, and in a nuclear plant, the radiation that it gives normally is not dangerous at all. And even if it has a meltdown like Fukushima, the radiation it gives is we have a warning ahead of time that the radiation is coming, unlike say in a coal accident or in a petroleum refinery accident. We've got warning and we've got time to get out of the area like they did, and that's why no one died. So this idea that like nuclear plants are just this like catastrophe waiting to happen is just completely wrong. Nuclear power is easily the safest form of energy.
Well, thanks very much for reaffirming this. We did have this discussion about a year ago on this show. It was, you know, probably a week after the earthquake, maybe only a couple days after. I can't remember how the dates fell last year. But we had people who called in and who knew
the
construction of the plants and how many different layers of insulation and what they were made of. And I read articles and I went through all the science and I was totally convinced that
we got a call from Japan as well.
Yeah, we did.
Rogan, yeah.
Yeah, we did get a call from someone who lived in Japan too. But we also got calls from people who knew the technology and knew how these plants were constructed. And I was convinced that it was perfectly safe. And you would think that any science-respecting culture would have, you know, after looking at things a year later, very sober, you know, not in the heat of the disaster and the emotion, that they would say, hey, we did really well. Let's continue to do this, not let's shut down some nuclear plants. So thanks very much, Derek. Anything else? on this topic?
If people want to read, Alex wrote a great article about this shortly after Fukushima. So if people want to read that, they should Google nuclear power is extremely safe. That's the truth about what we learned from Japan. I'm sorry I keep plugging my friend, but I do think his work's really good.
No, he does excellent work on this topic, so thanks very much. And that is also the link that you had there in the chat room. It's at foxnews.com, right?
Yep.
Thanks very much.
No problem.
Okay.
Now, we might be taking a chance, but
yeah.
he won't try.
Yeah, we have an unknown caller, so let's say hello. Hello, who's this?
Hi, Amy, it's Debbie.
Oh, Debbie, hey, you Debbie. Came up as unknown, so we said we have a mysterious unknown caller. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I'm a little angry about this topic because of the fact that nuclear is being maligned once again. I mean, for instance, when I Googled this, you know, the one-year anniversary of the earthquake and everything, I just got inundated with headlines in my search result that said, you know, one-year anniversary of Japan's nuclear disaster, right? So there wasn't an earthquake and a tsunami. That was sort of like a side note, the earthquake and the tsunami, or that's like in parentheses. But what it really was a nuclear disaster, even though nobody died as a result of nuclear radiation. And, you know, I can even add to some of the things that Derek was saying. Like, for instance, I actually read that you get more radiation outside of a coal power plant than you do outside of a nuclear power plant, because they restrict the amount of radiation that can be released so heavily that there's a certain amount of radioisotopes that are present in the stuff that they burn, just in the coal, like in everything really. But when they in the ash produced when they burn coal, and it's not a lot of radiation, by the way, but it's just like, you know, it's an interesting way to look at it for comparison, because you'd think that you'd be getting more radiation when you're outside of a nuclear plant, but you don't. You get like something, I think they're limited to 15 millirem, which is tiny compared to what you just get from just existing and walking around. Like, for instance, if you moved to Finland, I think you'd get like 5,000 millirem per year, which is the amount of dosage that people get in this 20, people would theoretically get in this 20-kilometer evacuation zone around the Fukushima plant. So that's considered dangerous, but it's actually no more dangerous to live there than it is to live in Finland. According to this book I read, it's called Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. It's a fascinating book. So that just goes to show how irrational people are about this, because I think that what's going on is that the anti-nuclear and anti-industrial people, they are exploiting the fact that there is this sort of visceral fear because of nuclear bombs and stuff, and because you can't see radiation, so it seems kind of sinister. You can't just look around and see if it's coming at you or not, you know?
Right. It's not smoke
the fact that,
Also, you know, the environmentalists, they love Earth, so it's earthquake. They have to reject that whole, you know, term. You know what I mean? The Earth is trying to kill us? No way. And we're killing us through nuclear plants.
That's right. Gaia would never hurt us.
Exactly. They hate that. They hate that word. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So, and then just to give you some idea also about the motivation, I used to work for a solar company, and I did at the time when this disaster happened. And my boss was gleeful. We had a meeting, you know, a couple of days, but just for an unrelated reason, in a staff meeting. He said he grinned ear to ear and said, "Well, I guess nuclear's dead."
Oh.
Like they were practically celebrating. He said, "Ha ha, good for us."
God.
You know.
Oh my gosh. Did you point out to him that the nuclear power plant performed extremely well under the circumstances, and so maybe it would be even a better sales pitch for nuclear?
People were dead, not the nuclear.
Well, at the time, it was like the day after it happened, so I didn't really have any information. I just
that's true, right? Yeah, it took a while for the information about the nuclear plant to come out.
Sounds like a ghoul.
Yeah.
What a rat.
Yeah, it was really stunning. I mean, but these are the same people who have also made comments to me before about how it's good for us if global warming is real, you know, and things like that. So, like, that's the mentality of these people who are opposing this nuclear energy. And it really makes me crazy. Like, as an engineer who's interested in energy, I just, I mean, I I understand how valuable this energy source is and how much amazing potential it has. And it just, it really makes me angry when I hear it being maligned. And the media really, I mean, they just really went at it. Like with this Fukushima, you'd think that there was a ticking nuclear time bomb, you know, and that we were in real danger of a nuclear explosion, and people in California were panicking because some of the radiation might blow across the Pacific.
Right, we were getting reports. We were getting reports from our government agencies.
Yes, and they're all in with this. Also, but you know, global warming has gotten a hit lately. I'm seeing in terms of people's attitude towards it. And Gore seems less happy. The less that the story of global warming seems real.
Yeah.
He seems less happy. I say, wait a minute, wouldn't he be happy?
They have their emotional alignment completely backwards.
I mean, it's...
They should be happy if global warming is false.
Absolutely.
They should be upset at any natural disaster, including one that befalls a nuclear power plant. They shouldn't say, oh, yeah, that's great. I mean, what, you know, if it takes an earthquake and a tsunami to help your solar industry.
That's right. If it takes 19,000 people killed and you overlook that, you know, for your own little vision of a non-nuclear world, these are sick people.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
They are. And when you think about all the people who have died in the pre-industrial era and just the horrible grim statistics about kids, you know, what percentage even lived past their fifth birthday, and then to try and argue that because somebody, you know, aside from Chernobyl, nobody's ever died from any kind of a nuclear plant. But even Chernobyl, it was like, it was less than 100 people. I think that the official number is in the 50s of people who deaths that are attributable directly to that accident. So, you know, even the Soviets couldn't manage to screw it up as bad as people kind of think they did. So,
right, right. Anyway, I don't know. And I don't know if there's any way to try to convince these people, because as I said, I mean, if they're already struggling financially, they have to rebuild all these vast areas within Japan that were destroyed by the earthquake and tsunami. And then they're going to shoot themselves in the foot and cost themselves a whole bunch of money by transitioning from nuclear to some other source of power. It is so, so counterintuitive. It's just mm-hmm. mind-boggling.
Yeah.
There's a book that some of the listeners type again. It's called The Health Hazards of Not Going Nuclear by Peter Beckman. Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. There are a lot of them. There's this book that I had cited earlier, you know, that was written by a woman who had been an environmentalist, and she was totally anti-nuclear, and then she learned more about it and became so convinced about its merits that she wrote an entire book in favor of nuclear and debunking all the myths of its supposed danger. So that might be also a good one to take a look at if you're interested.
Well, so maybe there's hope, right? Maybe somebody in Japan is going to talk some sense into these people, because I was kind of dumbfounded today. I thought, we already talked about it on the show. We know what the truth is. Certainly the truth would win out in Japan, where they're so science-minded, and it seems to not be happening. It's just really sad. So, if you want to hang on, Deborah, or call back later, there's other things that are probably going to make you equally mad. We're going to talk about the Wall Street Journal's coverage of the latest so-called Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Yeah.
And I was just floored by the slant in the coverage. So hang on for that, okay, Deborah?
And thanks.
We'll talk to you soon.
The determination to refer to it as a conflict means that when people are killed and murdered, well, they're not really. It's just a conflict. So, therefore, it's not a war.
Yeah, and the people who just call it a conflict, they try to say, oh, nobody's wrong in particular and stuff. So, there's...
That book some listeners mentioned, The Health Hazard of Not Going Nuclear, was written in 1979. Wow.
Yeah. And people still don't get the message today.
No.
And they still use something like, you know, the earthquake and tsunami in Japan as a pretext. So let's talk about what has happened between Israel and the so-called Palestinians over the last week. I went to Drudge Report, which... I don't know. It's becoming more and more a dubious source of news.
Not
that they... I mean, they link to real news stories.
But they also link to Alex Jones.
Yeah, and they link to a real news story in this instance. It was a story from the Israel National News. IsraelNationalNews.com is where I got my first story. And the focus of the story was on the Iron Dome technology that they have right now. It's anti-missile technology. So they have missiles that they use to intercept the missile attacks that come from Gaza.
So are those called the Iran Dome? So,
no.
You know, I guess they could change it in the future.
It's called Iron Dome. And the story is that it was able to foil 90% of the missiles that were
that were
lobbed at the urban centers. Mm. They didn't use the Iron Dome to try to intercept all the missiles that were coming over, because there was something on the order of 120 different missiles that came from Gaza over the last week.
How about using more missiles as well, Israel? Not just defending themselves, but... You know,
well, and they do some of that too, which is good, right? But when you first see this story, and this is Drudge, you know, Iron Dome is foiling 90% of the missile attack, and you say, okay, well, that's good, right? Because they've got this technology that is able to successfully intercept these missiles that come over. The problem is that the missiles that are being sent over by not necessarily Hamas, but sometimes it's other jihadist groups who are operating within Gaza, and they aren't discouraged by Hamas. You know, Hamas, actually this time it wasn't Fatah.
Oh, okay.
There were a couple different groups, and I've got the story here.
Was it the non-Muslim terrorists, or there were the Muslim?
Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees is another.
Committee. They're murderers, but they call themselves committee.
Yeah, nice. But, you know, in any event, so they spend very little on the missiles that they send over to Israel, which is, of course, why they rarely hit anything, too.
They're low budget.
But very low budget. And each Iron Dome anti-missile, and I think they fired about 30 of these things in the last week, each costs $50,000.
Wow. Of the domes.
Each of the Iron Dome missiles costs $50,000. So this is not a sustainable model in terms of them defending themselves.
Well, they have to go there and wipe out the terrorist groups, bomb their buildings, because they have offices there, literally.
And this is
they have to stop
right. And when
the war.
When I dug deeper to actually figure out what started the entire thing.
They're playing defense, as always.
Well, no, but actually this was started because Israel distinctly targeted two members of the so-called Popular Resistance Committee terror organization on Friday. And that squad, this article says, was responsible for planning a combined terror attack that was to take place via the Sinai Peninsula and the Israel-Egypt border.
Okay.
So this was Israel preemptively killing these guys that were going to attack them.
Because this is good, right?
And this is, you know, they
can defeat them overnight, is what I'm saying. That's all.
Right.
They can.
But this idea that they're going to spend so much just on purely reactive technology.
I know. That's what I'm saying. They got to get on the offensive. They have to go in there and take them out.
It is not sustainable. So then listen to this. This article in particular just made me say, ugh, I was upset with it, because, you know, they're talking about our technology successful, it gets 90% of the missile attacks, and we can defend ourselves. Of course, it costs a lot, but hey, you know, that's life. And then there's this paragraph that says, despite the rocket barrage, Israel kept open the Erez crossing for passengers and employees of international organizations operating in Gaza.
Huh.
Right?
Kareem Shalom.
Kareem Shalom was open for the delivery of 200 truckloads to Gaza residents. So they're spending $50,000 per...
And then they're allowing
maybe some of the stuff that's used to build the missiles to go in to Gaza, because they don't want to be accused of being anti-humanitarian and choking off the supply lines to the poor, quote-unquote, Palestinians who live in Gaza, right? So... it just seems so unsustainable.
It's self-destructive. I mean, they're just...
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I'm glad that they did target the two members of this.
Sure. That's not enough. That's just the beginning.
And they did succeed, of course. Israel is so accurate with its weapons that they will.
At its own expense.
They'll target and get these terrorists like in their car, and they'll just hit the car, and then they'll be done. And if the people in Hamas or the people who were living in Gaza that Hamas didn't do anything to stop, if they just didn't do anything and they realized, okay, well, I guess they got one of our guys, then it would stop there. But then these groups, you know, the Popular Resistance Committee and Islamic Jihad, they send the missiles back. And that's what Israel has been doing, right?
This is I guess they picked it up from the Associated Press, but they did put it on their thing.
Right. So that was the first story that I saw. So then I say, okay, well, I do an electronic subscription to the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal is supposed to give us complete news coverage. Why don't I go see if I can learn more about this at the Wall Street Journal? And then here's the headline that I see. Granted, it was probably picked up from the Associated Press, but the Wall Street Journal just puts it right out there as their story. Updated March 11th, 2012. So this morning, the story reads, 3 Palestinians killed in Israeli airstrikes.
That's it.
Three Palestinians. So nothing about, Israel goes after these guys. Just
and
the
Palestinians,
terrorists.
Not just, trying to say innocent civilians have been killed.
So it's not like they give you the chronology. It's not that they give you the predominance of who was really attacking whom. It's 3 Palestinians killed in Israeli airstrikes, and then
that's the title.
You know, of course, the story comes out of Gaza. It says Israeli airstrikes killed 3 Palestinians, including a schoolboy, in the Gaza Strip on Sunday.
As far as they put that in the cover.
And then it says while Gaza rocket squads fired salvos into southern Israel, deepening the worst rounds of violence.
So it was just
Gaza rocket squads fired and stuff. And it doesn't give you any idea of the chronology or who started. It's just focus on these 3 Palestinians. And then listen to the pulling of the heartstrings more, a little bit deeper down the story. It says Gaza health official Adam Abu Salmiya said that the militant was killed at a rocket launching site in Gaza City. So this is one of the 3. There was one militant killed, right? The boy was hit while walking with a friend to school in the northern city of Jabalia, and the guard died. There was a guard who died while walking with his dog, who was also killed. So a dog was killed too. So you are going to say bad
Muslim is walking with a dog?
Bad Israelis. Bad Israelis. Well, I think dogs are allowed if they are hunting tools or guarding tools, right?
I guess, yeah, they are. They're hunting tools, but I guess where would they be hunting? What?
So the focus is the bad Israelis killing, and then you have a picture,
and the
picture is of the women screaming and mourning.
They can't wait for
this, right?
They can't wait to mourn.
And, of course, when Israel does fire missiles into the Gaza Strip, they're either doing what they did to start this round, which was killing a particular person who is the mastermind of some sort of attack that they're plotting against Israel. So they will very surgically target. And I've seen some of this technology. I used to work at the Air Force Academy, and people told me about all the technology that's available. They can be so precise with these missiles. They can shoot a missile into one window of one building.
Well,
they can hit it on one car. So,
I'd love to see music again for the officers of Hamas and Fatah and all of them.
Well, and they do some of this.
Every
time.
So when
the missiles are being shot, what they do is they go ahead and they fire at the places that these were coming out of, right? So that's what they were doing. And so there's sometimes a civilian who's killed. And if there's any civilian who's killed,
of course it's a news story.
It's a huge news story
with the headline.
You know what?
Israel, whatever has not done its part to tell the truth. They haven't. They have allowed the scum like this title to just go unanswered. They say, "What are you gonna do?" type thing. No, they have to explain themselves. Go out there and then do a press conference, whatever.
Got Derek in the chat room saying U.S. should stop subsidizing Israel and start giving it moral sanction, and I could not agree more. I looked into the issue of the subsidizing, and actually when I tweeted this out today, this story, I got someone who I think is a follower of the Ayn Rand bot and probably sympathetic to the so-called Palestinians, and wrote back and said, oh, this is shameful because people in Israel are living there against the wishes of the people who inhabited the area, and the U.S. is subsidizing it. We should get rid of that excuse, that subsidizing Israel part, because as far as I know, our current program of subsidies to both Israel and its enemies, because we subsidize Israel's enemies too, it makes Israel worse off.
We fund terrorists.
And we have so many strings.
The U.S. government funds terrorists.
And we have so many strings attached to the money that we give to Israel anyway. The amount of good it actually does them is dubious.
The Bush administration did it. Obama did it. Who knows how many last presidents have done it. They funded terrorists.
They could do fine on their own. There's no doubt about that. So
just give them the green light.
You know, in terms of the Wall Street Journal coverage, they have this pro-Palestinian sympathy focus of the headlines and the opening paragraphs. You can get
they're weak
the
on
essential
Islam
facts.
As well. The Wall Street Journal, they're very weak on Islam as well. They are.
Are they?
Yeah.
Are they? You can get the essential facts from the story if you continue to dig into it, but they do not have the quotations, high quality quotations from Netanyahu or from the Islamic or, you know, Palestinian or whatever groups within the Gaza Strip that I think will give you a little bit more accurate picture of what's going on. So, for example, the quotation that they have from Netanyahu in the Wall Street Journal story, he says, we exacted a heavy price and continue to exact it, Mr. Netanyahu said of the Israeli strikes on Gaza. We will continue to overcome these terror threats, end quote. So that's good.
Yeah, but
you know, it's kind of vague.
Yeah, it also will deal with this for the rest of our lives.
And then there was another chief military spokesman, Brigadier General Yoav Moradishai, from Israel as well. He says, "We will continue to attack the terror cells that try to attack us." So that's a good one as well. But it's not nearly as good a quotation.
No, they're powerful. They can
or coverage that as the coverage that I found in the Washington Times today. So I went over to the Washington Times. I had written a little piece for them a couple weeks ago and knew that they were a unbiased
but even that
news source.
Little, you know, three killed, three what? Three humans, three what?
Okay, well let me get the headline out here. So this is the Washington Times story. The headline on theirs is three killed in third day of Gaza-Israel violence. So this is an ongoing story for the Washington Times. They're covering it as it goes along, but it's three killed in third day of Gaza-Israel violence. I like the choice of Gaza-Israel violence better than Palestinian-Israel violence, right?
But the name also.
What do you mean?
Ibrahim Barzak, I don't know, but go on.
I don't know. But I found that this story presented a complete set of the facts, and it didn't focus so much on, you know, immediately from the get-go.
But how about Israel responds to, you know, how about that one?
Well, I mean, the truth of the matter is that Israel did start this round.
Well,
so
they didn't start it. Yeah. They're responding to those who wanted to kill
them. Right.
It
was a preemptive attack.
Absolutely.
It was a preemptive attack.
They have every right to do that.
So the first, and they have a right to do it completely. And the thing about this article is that this article presents the complete case for the preemptive
Israel's
attack
preemptive
a lot
attack,
better.
Attack, you know, brings on something like that for the title fun. I mean, I respect that title more. That's all.
I would like it better. But I like this coverage so much better than the Wall Street Journal that I'm recommending it to you. And the coverage on foreign policy issues in general that they have over there is far,
well, Washington
far
Times is
better.
Probably the best when it comes to these kind of issues, when it comes to the war. They are.
Right. And, I mean, and there's sometimes that I even quibble a little bit with wording and
I would
stuff
as well,
that they have. But
believe me, but compared to
but,
New York
but,
Times,
yeah.
even Wall Street Journal,
right.
They are.
So, and it's just sad that we have to choose our media sources in order to get the complete story. You'd think any good, reputable media source would give you everything that you need, but it's just not true anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Thankfully, we have the internet so that I can find all these different sources
and
really
quickly. And if you dig enough, you'll find a good source.
Right. So here they say cross-border fighting between Gaza and Israel, touched off by Israel's killing of a top militant leader, showed no signs of letting up on its third day Sunday. So I like that. At the very beginning, they tell you exactly the context. that it was touched off by Israel's killing of a top militant leader. I don't necessarily like the use of the word militant, but at least gives you an idea of the context. It doesn't start out, again, let me grab this Wall Street Journal one. It doesn't start out and say, Israeli airstrikes killed three Palestinians, including a schoolboy in the Gaza Strip on Sunday.
Just out of the blue, they say, you know what, let's just kill some Palestinians.
There's this nice schoolboy, let's just kill him.
One second, Robert does say Investor Business Daily is the best on this issue, and I'd agree because they do use Islam for Islam and such. Go on.
So maybe when it's time for me to renew my subscription, I should jump over to Investors Business Daily.
He's right.
Okay. I will take a look at that. One of the reasons I subscribed to the Wall Street Journal when I chose my subscription was because I liked the editorials, the authors of
sometimes
of the editorials.
They're excellent.
And I wanted to have access to all those. And
no
Wall
doubt.
Street Journal doesn't allow free access to stuff the way some of the other papers do. So here we go. We've got a call. We'll take in a minute. But let me finish talking about this this article here. So they say, Gaza militants fired dozens of rockets at Israeli towns, hitting an empty school, and Israeli airstrikes killed three Gazans, including a boy and a farm guard. It was a farm guard. That's why they had the dog.
All right. Hunting tools.
Yeah, they're allowed to have dogs to guard their farms.
Not dogs. Hunting tools. Guys.
Yes. In any event, the empty school, the only reason the school was empty, I learned, was because the Israelis kept their children home, knowing that these rocket strikes were happening. So otherwise, the school was purposefully targeted. So you have a clearer picture.
Yeah.
You've got,
why they did what they did.
You know, these Islamic groups are purposefully targeting civilians and civilian populations. The Israelis are not doing any of that.
That's
a picture that you get from this Washington Times coverage that you don't get from the
Wall Street
Journal.
And that's as simple as that. They target civilians. Israel tries to avoid them.
Yeah. And then they say Hamas itself wasn't firing the rockets at Israel this time,
but it did not
try to stop two smaller Gaza groups, which were Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees. Now, here's the quotation from Netanyahu that I thought was so good. He says, "We have a clear policy," and he's talking about the fact that they had targeted these two militants from the Popular Resistance Committees who had planned terror attacks against Israel. So they did this preemptive strike. So he's defending that. He says, "We have a clear policy. We will hit anyone who plans to harm us, who prepares to harm us, and who harms us," Mr. Netanyahu said in a meeting with local leaders. So we will hit anyone who plans to harm us, who prepares to harm us, and who harms us.
That's good.
And he says, we will conduct preemptive strikes. Now, if that's his policy across the board and not just with respect to Hamas, maybe they will do something about Iran.
Maybe they will. I hope they will. They have to. They have no choice. Iran will force the issue.
Israel said it launched Friday's initial airstrike, which killed PRC leader Zuhair al-Qaisi in a car in downtown Gaza. So they just got this one guy in a car in downtown Gaza. And they did this to stop a plan by his splinter group to infiltrate into Israel through Egypt's lawless Sinai Peninsula. Israel said that the PRC was behind an attack on the border in August, killing eight Israelis. So they have evidence that this group was behind a previous attack.
Yep.
They had evidence that they were planning an attack. They knew exactly how they were going to conduct the attack, who was responsible. They get one missile. They hit it on a car carrying the guy, the bad guy. That's how they started this. And then, of course, all these missiles come over from Hamas, indiscriminately going after kids.
I know what you're saying. But,
no, I know. But the point is that you only get the details.
But in the title would have been great. Preemptive attack brings this, you know what I mean? Brings this reaction from.
Right. But you get
sure,
it in
the first
sentence.
Still, there's that thing where
you get the context and the essence of the story in the very first sentence, which I think is excellent.
Scrupulous when it comes to these things. This is a major problem that Israel is dealing with, this kind of propaganda from the other side, and it seeps into even the good papers. It seeps in.
Now listen to, giving again more kudos to Washington Times, they collected a quotation from a PRC spokesman. Again, this is a group called the
Popular Resistance Committee, whoever they are.
It's a terrorist group. It doesn't want to sound like a terrorist group.
Exactly. So this is someone's, he has a nom de guerre, Abu Mujahid or something, Mujahid.
Yeah.
He says, "We will not give calm for free, and the blood of our leaders and martyrs will not be spilled in vain."
He sounds like a reasonable
end
guy.
Quote.
He sounds like a reasonable guy. Like,
hey, we should
like
invite
a, like
him over for
yeah.
a poker game.
Pork, beer.
Yeah, a lot of bacon.
An Allah Ak barbecue, you know what I mean? Allah Ak barbecue.
I like it. But, you know, so he's the blood of our leaders and martyrs. So
this guy's hungry for
he's saying
Israeli blood.
Their leaders and martyrs yes, are the type of people who are plotting
we'll
terrorist attacks against
yeah.
Israel.
Yes.
And those are the people that they're trying to avenge.
And just contrast
right?
Netanyahu with this. And this is the problem here. They're yeah. dealing with genocidal people.
Now listen to Hamas.
Suicidal even.
They're describing what Hamas is doing in the meantime. Trying to claim a middle ground. Hamas leaders issued fiery statements Sunday in support of those firing rockets, but Gaza Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh also noted that, quote,
I drew that guy.
The brothers in Egypt are working around the clock to stop the Israeli aggression, end quote.
Well, I mean, look, self-defensive measures are aggression. You know, if you don't allow them to kill you, you're not playing along. I mean, you're not doing your part. You know what I mean? So therefore, you are at war with them.
Yeah, if you think you have the right to exist there.
If you resist Islam, you're at war with Islam. That's, yeah.
As for the United States and the United Nations, what was our reaction during this conflict? Of course, the United States called on both sides to show restraint.
Oh, man. Hey, terrorists, show restraint. Hey, civilized individuals, show restraint.
Yeah, I mean, I think Israel should just stop trying to prevent these terrorist attacks against itself. It's just so terrible.
Absolutely.
How dare it try to
They're
do
like
that?
They're like warmongers by just defending themselves.
And
this
then
is sarcasm, by the way, just anyone yeah. who wants to take it out of context.
Later in the story is where you learn about the school. It says one of the rockets that were shot at southern Israel, just in one day on Sunday, Palestinians fired more than 30 rockets at southern Israel. One struck the courtyard of an empty school in Beersheba. And it says Sunday is a school day in Israel, but schools in rocket range were closed to try to prevent casualty. So you can imagine in this courtyard, that's where they'd have recess. All these kids would be out there in the courtyard. They deliberately target this. Mm-hmm. That's what they do.
I should read something quick from the chat.
Yes.
And then just tell me what you think, because I had a thought right there.
Okay.
Deborah writes, Obama wants Israel to wait until after the American election before taking action against Iran. Why do you think?
I saw a number of stories
that's
like
it.
That.
He'll put the clamp on if he gets a second term. He'll put the absolute clamp on.
Yeah, the story that she's citing is one that I saw earlier this week. And I, you know, whether this was actually true that the bunker busters were requested, whether the bunker busters were promised or not, this is evil, right? It says that Obama would give Israel the bunker buster bombs that it wants and that it needs in order to stop Iran's nuclear program. But only if they wait till after the election. First of all, how does anyone know that we have until after the election to stop this thing, first of all? Second of all, talk about the tail wag the dog kind of stuff.
Let's put Israel at the mercy of the enemy and of us.
It's terrible. So I think this is an ample illustration that we do. Maybe we need to go to Washington Times. Maybe we need to go to Investors Business Daily.
You'll get
the
truth
in the
eventually.
In order to get the full context and story, and I definitely appreciate the approach where in the first sentence or two you get the context. I hate these stories that start out and say, oh, Israel killed 3 people in Gaza, and you say, well, there's got to be a reason why, you know, how did this happen? And they don't tell you until the very end of the story, and they kind of hide it behind non-essentials at that.
Robert writes, he goes, sadly, Israel hasn't fully rejected the code of self-sacrifice, or else they would act much more independently and disproportionately in terms of extinguishing their enemies. And just one more thing. There's a Muslim, a Western Muslim in Germany. I probably repeated before. It's worth repeating again. His name is Bassam Tibi, and he understands jihad. I don't know why he's still part of Islam, but anyway, he had a whole paragraph about what jihad means, what it'll, but his the finishing sentence is this, and this is the problem here. He goes, those who resist Islam cause wars and are responsible for them. And that's that. He goes, Muslims cannot wage war. only non-Muslims can. We have to submit. And if we don't submit, they have every right to, you know.
Our not submitting is an act of war,
yes, exactly,
in and of itself. Let's go ahead and take this call. We're at the top of the hour, and we're talking about the news coverage of the latest Israel-Gaza conflict. Hi, who's this?
Hi, it's Harold. Amy.
Hi, Harold.
I tried to call in earlier. I had an internet outage. I tried to call in earlier during the Japan nuclear thing, but I have comments on both of these subjects.
Okay.
I have an upbeat comment on the nuclear, so I'll get this one done with quickly first. I looked at this whole raid on Iran thing, whether it's possible or not, and my favorite site is globalsecurity.org, so I went there, took a look at the Israeli capabilities because I thought they did not have a heavy lift capability. So I looked at what equipment they have, and they do have an ability to basically carry 20,000 kilograms. So that's bunker busters about 15 tons. So they have room left over for the external fuel tanks to make the range. They have the range capability, and they have the weight capability, and they have enough equipment. So right there, that kind of told me technically they're capable. Global Security also showed the map of all the potential targets. There's about two dozen of them. Most of them are in central or western Iran, only one or two targets in the east. So really all that Israel would need would be the bunker busters, and they would have the full technical capability of staging a sizable raid. I was thinking to myself, well, you know, what if the U.S. just refuses to give it to them? Well, maybe they should use some homegrown technology. It might be about 50 times stronger, leave some glass behind, but it'll definitely knock down a mountain if they need it to.
Right.
So that would be the, you know, existential option if they were forced to and they had no choice. You can go with some, you know, small nukes, I guess, would do the job perfectly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they do have an option. If they felt really, really with a back to the wall, they might end up having to do that. So I think Obama is better off just giving them the technology, because otherwise they can start playing political games. They can start, you know, start doing movements on the ground that the Russians will see on their satellites and think that they're preparing nukes. And this could play, they could cause all kinds of very serious politics between Russia and America. So it's just not in Obama's interest to get any of this started. You should keep it clean, just give them the bunker busters and keep the whole thing clean and simple.
Right. Now, if they do start, and if Iran is, you know, this is one thing that I saw on Fox News. I think Megyn Kelly had a guest on, and I watched the clip, and I forget. Do you remember? I think I told you about it. I can't remember the name of the guy. This guy, he had been in the Iran National Guard or something, and he wrote a book. He's now kind of undercover. He doesn't show his face. You only hear his voice on the media. And he was saying he believes that Iran is further along, and that they have 800 cells throughout the United States prepared to attack us if anything happens. And so in essence, he's trying to argue that it's already too late if we try to do something now.
Well, I believe that's true. I believe they have cells. Yeah.
That is just a whole bunch of bluster, just to try to make us not take any action.
Of course.
We can just safely ignore all of that.
But they do have spies here, no doubt.
Yeah, probably. But if they start something, I think we'll finish it.
Well, they already have. I mean, that's the point. For 30 years, they've been at war with us, and we just haven't responded, you know, correctly. We just haven't.
Yeah. On the Japan nuclear thing, I have some good things to say here.
Excellent.
There's two things. Firstly, conventional nuclear plants are really not very good. I mean, because of the safety issues, they have to put a whole bunch of additional hardware in, which reduces the efficiency. Also, you load up the reactor with several years' worth of fuel. That's like putting your whole gas tank inside your engine and hoping nothing bad happens. It's just potentially, you know, unstable. There is other material that's similar. It's thorium-230, uranium-235. And it can do the same thing. It's more plentiful, and it has no unstable possibilities. It doesn't naturally react. You have to do something to make it react. And India is right now building a whole bunch of plants to do that. And we could do the same thing. The U.S. developed it back in the 1960s, and it's quite a useful thing to do. It's similar to uranium, but it just has no military possibilities. So that may be why we never did it, because it was dual use and cheaper to go dual use than just to do commercial power with no military possibilities.
Okay.
The other thing, the second thing, which is the future, but in fairly close future, is nuclear fusion. Now, you know, I haven't been paying attention, but I suddenly decided to look into it. And it turns out huge advances have been made in nuclear fusion over the last 20 years. There are big prototypes in operation in the world. Most of them need more power in than what they put out. But that's only because it turns out it's a scaling problem. So they have a new project in Europe now. It's EU plus China, India, Japan, US, and South Korea. And it's about a $10 billion project. All the countries have put up their money for the project. And it's going to come online in about 7 years. It will have a queue of 10, meaning they ignite with 50 megawatts and they get 500 megawatts back. And at no time do they have more than half a gram of fuel in the vacuum chamber. So in other words, the fuel is external and they feed it in like a car. You know, when you press the accelerator harder, you get more fuel.
Okay.
So basically this thing runs, it's totally safe. And in the process of, you know, they have a 50-50 mixture of deuterium and tritium. In the process, it gives out, you know, helium and one neutron. That's where all the energy comes from. They have a blanket around it with lithium in, you know, ceramic pipes. And the neutrons hit the lithium and make more tritium. So they generate their own fuel once they start it. And
so it's self-perpetuating technology as well, is the idea.
Right. But the reaction doesn't happen in the chamber, only the part they want to. The creation of new fuel happens outside the chamber, and they then go through a chemical process, refine it, and add it to the fuel tank and continue. And the good news, this is on the first one on an industrial scale. They're not going to be making any electricity with it. They're just going to be venting all the heat into the air. But they have a plant that's coming after that, and that will be a 4 gigawatt, basically 4,000 megawatts, the same size as a conventional coal-fired plant, and that's what's coming in less than 20 years. So I don't even see why it's worth wasting time on all these alternatives right now for electricity. We have a future. It's coming. And, you know,
you mean solar and the like, why should people waste on solar and wind and stuff? They should instead put their eggs into this basket that you're describing.
Yeah, solar and wind are different. You know, solar has a very high cost of energy to prepare all the materials, and so you may never get that energy back, whereas wind is a very mature, good technology, but it's low density, meaning you need a lot of land to make a little energy. Whereas
right.
Nuclear plant on a couple of acres, this new thing in the south of France they're building now is only a 10-story building with a reactor inside the building. It's just a big vacuum tube, you know, that they inject, and they have these superconducting magnets. But all this technology is very well, they're just doing it on a bigger scale now, and it's going to work. I mean, it's already worked,
okay.
and it's just going to work better.
If we go back to the Japan story, even with conventional nuclear power, would you recommend that Japan scale back its dependence on nuclear power as a result of what happened at Fukushima?
The only thing about Japan I don't like is the design of their plants. They have old General Electric plants that are really bad designs. If they used a modern design that is automatically self-extinguishing, they just wouldn't have had that problem. They rely on very old technology.
Don't you agree that there was relatively little problem given the scale of that natural disaster that hit the plant?
Well, remember, they've got to take into account seismic problems. Like, for example, in Virginia.
But not of magnitude on a routine basis.
Well, in Virginia, they had an earthquake recently, and it was a 5.9. The nuclear plants in Virginia are designed to take a 6.3, and they know historically they're never going to get anything, so they've designed it already in. The question is, did the Japanese take account of all the natural facts that they were supposed to, you know? So
as I recall from talking last year at this time to someone who knew about the design of the plant and the various layers of insulation and what each one had, and they had this layer of water and all the different things. I looked at all this last year. They really had it covered, and I think that they did a good job overall, and I would not recommend. I mean, yeah, it'll be great if they come up with an even safer version of nuclear technology that you're describing. That sounds wonderful. But at this time, I wouldn't recommend that they scale back their dependence on it. I mean, maybe they want to make a couple tweaks to make the plants a little bit safer or something, but to say we're going to go ahead and retrench and try to figure out how to, you know, supply our energy needs when we're already suffering and we're trying to rebuild after a disaster. It seems like they're putting way too much on themselves, and that it's wrong and it's not worth it. So
they have to go with what exists right now just to get by for the next 10 or 20 years. But they could go with thorium reactors very quickly. They like uranium. It's very similar to uranium, except it's much safer.
Will it always cost $10 billion to build a plant?
No, I didn't say it's a plant. That's an experimental reactor in France.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of scientists, and you know that's what's going on right now. They're testing materials for the inside of the chamber to see which ones, you know, the steel. What's going to happen to the steel
You think it's going to translate into technology that can be proliferated at a reasonable cost, such that it'll provide electricity for people?
Yeah, it'll be the power equivalent of a conventional coal-fired plant, with all the advantages of not having to have a couple of train loads of coal arrive every day and where to store it and handle it. So I like that much better, because I think it'll be cleaner. Just from people, sulfur dioxide is not so good to breathe in.
Okay, well, if so, that sounds like great news. I've got people
in the
chat room who are saying that uranium really isn't unsafe, and I've got a number of people who think that our existing nuclear technology is quite safe and that you wouldn't stop it. Yeah, I mean, if we can come up with something better, and especially maybe even something cheaper down the road like you're talking about, that would be wonderful. But I was just amazed that that Japan was going to throw the stuff overboard, throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
Yeah, by the way, the name of this project in France is ITER, like ITER. It's International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor.
Okay.
And so the wiki has a one page, Wikipedia has a one page on it. And then the big commercial plant that's coming next is called DEMO, D-E-M-O, and that's also there. So people can just look it up themselves. It's very clearly explained, and it's all there.
It sounds fabulous. I'm amazed that people are still innovating such wonderful things in today's age with our governments too. Yeah.
What has amazed me, I've started looking into all the different physics things that have been going on over the last 15 years, and I started studying them the last couple of weeks. There is a tremendous breakthrough that's been made in the understanding of the universe. People have been putting in all kinds of work into experimental and theory, and it's all coming together. Quantum computing has been coming together, and this nuclear power is coming together. So as mankind advances technically, our philosophy obviously has not been keeping a pace.
Yeah, we've got to see if we can correct that, which is part of the reason we do this show. So.
Yeah.
Oh, and just another quick point, Maine has become a three-way race.
Okay.
So that's,
and so
what
do you think that's going to help in terms of a better candidate?
It helps for leverage. You've got more leverage. You can pick either one of the three, which one you want to help, and then just throw everything into that one. Or you can even play games and help. You know, if there's two of them look like they're close, you can always play games and, you know, give some support to the other one to make them more closer or whatever.
Okay.
There's all kinds of possibilities for mischief in Maine.
Okay, well, keep us posted, and we'll talk again. Thank you, Harold.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so
Discussion. Want to talk about the emo thing, or just quick?
We've got plenty of time to do this stuff. So you actually have a question here in the chat room that we missed during the call here. It's to you from Juji Fruit in the chat room, and the question is, what do you think Barack Obama will do in regards to Iran after the election?
Well, the first answer, zero, nothing. And the second one, if it helps him politically somehow, some way, he might do something. He might allow
before the election.
Yes, before.
Yeah.
But you know, after election, I don't see him do anything. You know, if it helps him, he might do something. If it helps us, he'll weigh that, because he's a politician through and through.
Given what Barack Obama has done during his first term, I would be so scared of anything that
he would do on any front during the second term. He had to hold back.
When he's not,
because he's
running for re-election.
He's a frustrated
dictator.
That's what he is. He's a frustrated dictator, so, you know, make way. If he somehow sneaks through, if enough idiots vote for him, you know, we are in deep.
And another wonderful thing that the Obama administration is doing, its Justice Department this week threatened to sue Apple along with some book publishers because of the prices that they were charging on ebooks. And this story came out Thursday, March 8th, which, as I recall, is exactly the day after Apple announced its new iPad.
Okay, yeah.
Right? So talk about raining on a parade.
Oh, yeah.
New iPad, exciting features. You watched the launch video, right? So tell us a little about it.
I don't know much.
What do you remember about the new iPad? Well, what's better about it?
Well, supposedly the quality of the screen of the images are even better than televisions. That's what I'm saying within that decimal area.
I think they're calling it HD, right?
Yeah, I think so, but that's not the name. I mean, third generation iPad. People were griping. I think Gizmodo, whatever. It's heavier. It's a little thicker than the last one. Maybe it is. I don't know. It looks beautiful. I don't know. Yeah. I saw the guy, Tim Cook, the current CEO of Apple. I heard he's pretty withdrawn. He was good. I mean, he reminded me a little, I guess, of Jobs. Maybe he picked up certain things. But I can't say concretely. I saw maybe half of it on and on. I was drawing, watching over back and forth, but... I know one thing. In one of the new ads, they had some kids reading a Superman comic, which is cool because they haven't pushed that aspect of it. For myself, when I saw the iPad, the first thing I thought about comic books. That was it. It was as limited as that. It was like, oh, reading comic books on this will be ideal, and it is ideal. I read a lot of comic books on the iPad. It's beautiful.
So faster, better.
Yeah, faster, better. I think it also has the white edges instead of black. I prefer the black, just personally, as a nice frame, as aesthetically speaking.
Right.
But faster, better. The camera's supposed to be better, sharper, clearer. I don't know.
So everything's just a bit better. But in terms of...
I don't know.
Oh, I think there's another thing, too, but they announced...
You might know more than me.
I think they announced in conjunction with it a new feature of being able to store your movies and your TV shows better
through
iCloud or something.
That sounds right.
So that you can watch them better. There was a number of features. Anyway, so they have this big product launch, and then the day after this story hits...
Because these are parasites, the government, and they want to get the headlines because Apple is in the news at the moment.
Yeah.
So you know what? Let's just put Apple out there.
Apple's too full of itself. Its stock price is too high. Whatever stupid pretense they have...
Apple deserves the Justice Department's attention. I mean, the real criminals in the world, you know.
Well, and sometimes, you know, the Justice Department comes after you only because one of your competitors is disgruntled and basically, you know, complains to the Justice Department that you have somehow
they went after Microsoft
conspired
for years.
In restraint of trade.
If they went after Osama bin Laden the way they went after Gates and Microsoft in the 90s, forget about it.
Yeah. So it says the Justice Department warned Apple and five major publishers that it plans to sue them, accusing them of colluding to raise prices of electronic books, a person familiar with the probe said on Thursday. So several parties who have held talks to settle the potential antitrust case said the person who was not authorized to speak publicly on the matter. Now, what does it mean when you settle an antitrust case? You pay a fine, you agree not to do things that were in your interest that you were doing before.
You can see that you're guilty, in a sense.
Well, not necessarily,
well, no,
right?
No, they want you to.
I mean, I just from looking at the previous FTC consent agreement with Facebook. Facebook never agreed that it had done anything wrong, and nonetheless, reached some sort of agreement with the FTC. So these people Apple doesn't necessarily have to say, "Yeah, we did something wrong."
Of course, but it's like Facebook. You know, Zuckerberg basically bent over and said, "Yeah, okay, you know, I'll do this," and then they said, "Okay, good." As soon as they thought that he was maybe, you know, up in the air about it, they just. What, 20 years now? They're locked into his private.
Yeah. Because Facebook may have not been as forthcoming as it should have been about its privacy policies, the FTC now has wrenched from Facebook the ability to dictate Facebook's privacy policies, the substance of those policies for the next 20 years.
I talked about this on a prior show. Billions, the government thinks you're guilty of something, so they come after
and you. They want to get their teeth into you. They want to get their control over you. So here we are. Now, unfortunately, there was something in the Jobs bio that sort of tipped off to them. And, you know, in the Steve Jobs' bio called iBio. Actually, it was just called Steve Jobs.
Right, I'm sorry.
iBio was the article that I wrote about the bio.
Right.
But,
so you're mistaken. You wrote the
biography. That's the name of the bio now. But in any event, in that biography, there were extensive descriptions of the way that Steve Jobs got, for instance, record companies to put songs on iTunes when the record companies were afraid it was going to destroy the whole music industry.
So the one individual in the government who actually reads, I guess, read that part and said, wait a minute, we got something here.
Yeah.
You know, that's it.
Yeah, the one person who wasn't browsing your website.
Exactly. Right. Sorry. This week, again, the Department of Homeland Security has come back. And they've come numerous times, and also now NASA for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think NASA means anything.
No, of course not. But what I'm saying is it's a government entity.
Department of Homeland Security is a frequent visitor of Bosch's website.
And some IPs from the Pentagon used to, but not anymore.
Well, the hope is that they're learning something from you. But anyway, yeah, so someone from the government actually read the Steve Jobs biography, and he said apparently Jobs was aware of the publisher's frustration with Amazon. And so what Steve Jobs says is, he says, okay, we'll have an agency model, as they call it, for pricing. So the publisher can set the price of the book to whatever it wants, and then iBooks, Apple, is going to get 30% of the price that the publisher chooses to charge.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yes, the customer pays a little bit more. He says, but that's what you want anyway. And then the publishers go to Amazon having that leverage, and they say, you're also going to sign an agency contract with us where we can set the price, or we're not going to give you the books. And remember, typically publishers, what they wanted to do was, I mean, not what they want to do, but publishers did in the past, publishers would sell bookstores, Amazon, retail outlets. They sell the books for a wholesale price.
Right.
And then Amazon or the retail outlets can choose to charge whatever price that they want. And now what they do with these ebooks, apparently with this agency model, is the publishers will say, you will charge X amount for this ebook and you can get whatever percentage, but you can't reduce the price without my permission. That's fine if they want to do it, right? But for this, they get sued under the antitrust laws. Sherman Antitrust is written, you know, if you do anything in the restraint of trade. And anything can be construed as restraining trade. And so, therefore, you can easily start a lawsuit. You can easily start a lawsuit and you can go in and impede somebody's business, right? So this is what they're going to do. They're going to sue for this. Now, I went on to Yerome Brooks and Don Watkins' new website. I think it's capitalism.aynrand.org. The title of the blog, I think, is Laissez-Faire. And they had a little article this week arguing that Apple should be able to charge whatever it wants for the books and government should not get involved at all. And it's exactly right. And I was surprised, though, in the discussion on that blog, they say, well, look, you know, Apple is restricting competition here, right? Because Apple says, look, we're doing our iBooks a certain way. The publishers are going to tell us what the price is. We're going to charge the price that the publisher tells us to charge. And we're going to give them a certain percentage.
The
customers buy or they don't buy it. And we're restricting competition because this gives leverage to the publishers to deal with Amazon the same way. And how evil it is, right? That
whenever I buy an iBook, I mean, there's like a gun to my head. It's just there. I mean, I'm just like, I'm forced
you
to
do it. Must yeah. buy the iBook.
It's
like
it's an iGun, I think. It's like
right.
It's an app, yeah.
Right.
An invisible gun. It's in my brain, I think.
You know, Amazon or Barnes & Noble, they could say, we don't want to go on this model.
One second.
There could be publishers who say they don't have
Deborah
to go
says,
on this model.
Deborah says, because you try to poo-poo the idea that NASA's on my blog, and Deborah says it's true. She goes, NASA says, well, Bosch, your blog may not be aligned with a new Obama-era mandate to make Muslims feel good about themselves. If you recall, remember? We did a cartoon.
Oh, right, yeah.
They want to make contact with the Muslim world, you know,
right.
The planet of the Muslims anyway.
Right. No, it's true. Okay, so back to this topic. So I was surprised at the number of people who are sympathetic with the Sherman antitrust law. And in fact, I believe it was Republicans
who caused that law to be passed back in 1890. In 1890, a lot of bad things started, including the so-called right to privacy. It was first proposed in an 1890 Law Review article, and the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed then.
Right before the turn of the century, just got the most rotten politicians.
Yeah, right around, you know, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century is when the progressives really started to take over. And they said, well, you know, we don't want you to restrain trade, whatever that means. It's so vague that anybody can be accused of restraining trade if you set prices too high or too low. If you have too much product available or too little product available, any sort of agreement that you make, and people...
We tell the government, you have too much power, you know.
Yeah, but what people do is they take this context that exists, the Sherman antitrust law. We have antitrust laws on the books. Oh, it must be protecting somebody. It must be good. And I think people have absorbed
it. 'Cause all laws
are good. They've absorbed it as the given, and they've forgotten the principle, which the principle is, as long as there's no initiation of force, as long as there isn't actually the gun to the head that Bosch just described.
The eye gun.
That's,
they put it in your head. Do you think it's there? That's why you buy iBooks, period. That's it.
Maybe the iPad, the new iPad, has a feature that makes you feel like the eye gun is pointing at your head.
It's bigger than a gun now. It's iNuke.
You have to buy the apps. You have to buy the books.
Right.
You have to buy the music.
He really did a job on us, Steve. I mean, really.
You with the puns. I don't know. But actually, we are missing Martin, who was our pun meister in the chat room.
He was here.
Was he here?
Yeah.
Did he give us some puns?
I don't know if he gave us puns. I'm trying to get one right now.
I feel deprived.
I just had a pun today. I said the submissionary position, and it was...
that's an old one.
Yeah, that is old one, actually.
Sorry, that's
it's
old.
It's my old book.
It's old and tired.
That's right.
Old and tired, gone. So I was, again, I'm surprised. People take this context for granted. They forget the principle of the initiation of force. All the government should be doing is retaliating against any initiation of force.
No.
So here, where do you see initiation of force? We have Steve Jobs talking to book publishers.
Nope.
And saying,
okay,
what can we do to get you, the book publishers, to offer these electronic book versions on our platform?
And this is the deal that we want, and you accept it or don't.
And the publishers say, well, we, you know, and he talks to some top publishers, he talks to a lot of the publishers, and they say, well, we'd be very happy with this agency model because we know we get a certain return that you wouldn't just keep reducing the price.
They want to be part of that app, they want to be part of the iPad. I mean,
right.
No doubt about
so
it.
This is a voluntary agreement between the publishers and Steve Jobs. They set a price, and then Steve Jobs and Apple offer those books through the iBooks platform to customers, and customers decide they like the price, they don't like the price. And suppose that, yes, this leverage is used, this bargaining leverage that the publishers gain by making this arrangement with Steve Jobs, and the publishers go to Amazon and they get the same kind of deal. And then they get to set the price over there as well.
Yep.
And then what if there's another platform? The point is that there is no gun, no force that prevents another company from coming into the market and saying, we're going to create a new, better platform, and publishers, if you want to deal with us, you can't set the price, we're going to do the price, or we want a price that's a slightly lower price point than yours, but we're going to guarantee more volume, and here's why. Or, look, we've done these market studies, and I took some economics in college, so I know that there's something called a demand curve that shows that down to a certain level of price, you will increase the quantity that you sell if you keep decreasing the price at a certain point. So... I think you could definitely come into a market if the prices are priced at a price point that's too high and do something about it. Customers won't buy it. You can exploit that customer base that wants a slightly lower price book. Competition is going to take care of the problem. And here you've got, as far as I know, a bunch of people just sour grapes. Some competitors who are disgruntled.
They're so successful that they... At a certain point, the competition is so lame that They just want to, I don't know.
I mean, the iBook solution, and I think also the Kindle platform has its own elegance too, but these platforms are so elegant in terms of a way to read a book that there's some premium that you should expect to pay for that as well. I like the idea that in order to acquire new books, I don't have to have more shelf space.
Right, right.
And that you can carry books with you wherever you go, a quite a respectable
take
library
notes
of books.
To this, look
yeah, you
up,
could
you know
take notes just, on it. You can do word searches.
It's incredible. I mean,
I love being able to do word searches, especially on some of the objectivist books.
You don't waste
books.
Time.
Yeah. So Robert in the chat room is recommending again Laissez-Faire of ARI. Yes, it's a new blog. It is an excellent site, and they're going to just keep building more and more resources about capitalism, including debunking this idea of monopolies. You know, suppose everybody bought iBooks. Suppose everybody bought iBooks.
Yeah.
Who cares? You know, other people are
in their mind. They're like, wait a minute.
Other people are free to enter the market at any
they
time.
Are.
And
if they don't think they could do it, that's their problem.
And it's happened time and time again in history. As soon as the government gets upset about a particular company, whether it be IBM or Alcoa, was another one of these companies, that the government decided it needed to address, I think AT&T, Ma Bell, whatever, they had to come in with antitrust, their big bludgeon, you know, club of antitrust, and just bludgeon them over the head.
Yep.
It would have happened. The competition would have kind of decreased their market share anyway in several years. I mean, as long as you leave people free, as long as you don't restrict market entry, and of course, none of these companies are restricting anybody else from entering.
Rosemary says, as Andrew Breitbart would say, so, you know the whole thing when people ask, you know, well, he's doing this, so.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean suppose everyone in the world said that it's
right.
Got to be iBooks or bust, you know.
That's right.
So
Deborah writes, how hugely ironic that the government, the agent of massive forcible restraint of trade, is trying to restrain trade by initiating force against traders and claiming that its intention is to protect against the restraint of trade. That's funny.
It's true.
You get a phone call. I don't know.
Yeah, we've got a new caller, so we're going to go ahead.
Might be a live one. We'll see.
Take it. Hello, who's this?
This is Bob.
Hi, Bob. So you have something on the topic here of antitrust?
Well, I'm listening. I just tuned in. I just tuned in the program. But, you know, I haven't given Ayn Rand's book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, a thorough reading. I plan to. I just purchased the book again. But the problem I'm having with it, all these subject matter, whether it's antitrust or the question that comes to my mind is, since we don't have how much pure capitalism do we have left in our system is the question that arises. How much of it isn't robber baron type capitalism? How much of it is
kind of crony
really,
capitalism?
I'm sorry?
Kind of crony capitalism?
Government's
crony capitalism, using that term now. And so I don't know. The question I have in mind is, how can anybody do any business at all in this kind of situation? And things like antitrust laws, this makes a case further for them, I guess.
Let me see if you have this kind of idea in mind. Do you have the idea in mind that because our market is really not free right now,
mm-hmm.
that
how free is it is the question.
Yeah, well, it's really not that free, right? So I mean, it's very unfree. So I could see somebody trying to make the following argument. Suppose you said, yeah, in a truly free market, this Steve Jobs making this agreement with the publishers wouldn't be a big deal because it's so easy to enter into the market as a competitor for Apple and Amazon and everything else that it'd be fine. But as it stands right now, it's hard for a new competitor, a maker of new technology to come in and grab any of that market share. And so maybe it really is restraining trade given the context of our mixed economy where there's not very much freedom. Is that kind of a concern of yours, or am I not getting...
I think that's kind of where I'm going with it.
Okay.
It's everything's so corrupt. Is how can you justify principles for capitalism in a system that isn't really capitalist, if you want to understand
what
I'm saying.
Yeah. Now here, so here's the thing. And we see this in every realm, right? So the government has entered into our medical industry, and it started doing this in the 60s by instituting Medicare and Medicaid, right?
Sure.
And so then what happens is healthcare gets more expensive, and then they have these... Yeah, and the other thing that the government did that messed up the healthcare industry is it tied our health insurance policies to our employers, either through tax incentives or otherwise, so that basically the whole health insurance industry is out of whack too. And people think of health insurance not as something that we get for catastrophic policies, but then they get into this weird HMO mentality where you expect to pay a fixed fee and get all the health care you need for an entire year no matter what happens, right? So it's the principle, and Ayn Rand talked about this in several contexts, but it's the principle of controls breed further controls. So we might say in this particular context with Apple that because the market isn't free, it is maybe harder for competitors, potential competitors of Apple and Amazon, to come in. And so then the Justice Department sees that it might be a little hard, and they say, oh, well, the answer is to have antitrust come in and kind of make
more
Apple
poison.
Yeah, and you're adding more poison. You are adding more government force. We're assuming that the problem is somewhat created by government force, which I think it is. But they're saying the answer is to add some more government force to the picture.
And I think the problem is also in arguing for laissez-faire economics is you have to kind of swing back and forth with economic theory and also with the moral aspects of capitalist system. So it's kind of I haven't studied economics at all, as you probably can tell, but it seems to me that it's a tedious job trying to advocate capitalism from economic theories and also from the moral aspect. And you have to kind of swing back and forth. I see that's what you do, but it's a tedious task, I'd say.
Well, and it gets even more convoluted when you can't apply basic economic principles cleanly in the context of our economy because there's so much government intervention. So that's even harder. So, I mean, what you can do is you can get pretty basic to the old moral principle, two wrongs don't make a right. So, you know, it's true that we're in this position where the market maybe isn't that free and it might be a little bit harder for competitors to enter, although I really don't believe that. I think the high-tech industry is still relatively free, and the rise of Apple and its ability to transform the publishing, you know, both music and book publishing
markets. Could that be because the government
market
knows really that we can't get in there because we don't understand it for nothing?
You
mean they,
what do you mean?
The government feels that they cannot go in there because they truly, truly cannot understand it.
I do think that the government hasn't been able to understand it well enough to get it.
Now, they don't understand healthcare and all this, yes, but it's so abstract to them.
But in any event,
amazing. For instance, Alan Greenspan, who has some essays in this book, Capitalism, Known Ideal, I read some of his essays in there. He really is, back in those days, he certainly had a good grasp on everything, but what happened to him?
Oh, I know. We thought, so many objectivists thought, that if he was in the Federal Reserve, that that was going to make things at least somewhat better.
Or at least knock out the Federal Reserve,
and
ultimately.
Yeah, that it would transition towards a place where you wouldn't have a Federal Reserve or need a Federal Reserve to control inflation. And he switched his thinking entirely during his tenure there. I think government participation in government tends to pull people.
His wife is left.
Her work. I reading that book at the beginning of the book. It's not a treatise on economics. It's basically a treatise on the moral aspects of capitalism, on morality in general. I guess she always approaches it from a moral aspect.
She's a great
professor. She created a new morality, and I think it's important to keep in mind that people can't grasp the morality that well. I've read The Virtue of Selfishness. I've read several of her books. I understand the concepts involved here, and I understand. I've used those. But it's difficult.
I mean, here in this context, this is how I would focus on the discussion. I would say, look, if the government comes in with its antitrust laws and forces Apple and the publishers to conduct their business in a way that they did not choose to voluntarily, right? Because voluntarily they chose to have this agency relationship. If the government comes in and says, no, you have to do it some other way, they are forcing, they are initiating force against these companies when these companies have not initiated force. So it's the government going outside its proper function. Government's proper function is to retaliate against those who initiate force. And in this case, none of these companies has initiated force. Now, if you then say, well, in today's context, because it's so hard for businesses, because of all these other, you know, government's just kind of being a Band-Aid here, you say, no, you get rid of the Band-Aids. The answer is to get rid of all the restraints that would make it hard for people to enter the market and to make it a more competitive market so that they can come in. But I agree with you.
I think that's where it has to be argued on moral premises and from the economic standpoint. That's what you're doing, but I mean, it's very difficult for me to present it that way myself.
Well, keep listening to the show and feel free to call in and ask any questions. And we'll go through issue by issue, whatever comes up.
Yes, okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye.
Okay. I think it's just so hard for people to get outside of the current context.
Well,
because the current context is so
fraught. Whenever people hear capitalism, when public school educated kids hear the word capitalism, they think something bad.
Or they think
they do.
They think that we have capitalism now.
Yes, and that's bad. It's like Howard Dean said, we had 8 years of capitalism during Bush. Look, 8 years of capitalism during Bush.
During Bush. Yeah, during the Bush administration.
Oh,
man,
we have not had clean capitalism.
What was the quotation from Harry Binswanger about the Bush administration? There was 50,000 new regulations
under
the
Bush
administration.
And he said, like,
yeah.
The Bush administration.
Yeah.
You know, they are all in, Democrat, Republican, everything. They don't pull back on this notion. They don't. They double down and say, hey, you want us to, you know, give up some of our power? Wait a minute, you know. They will never give up power. That's what they are. That's why they went to Washington, for power, the vast majority of them. The non-politicians, when they go there, they're the ones who actually, you know, try to fight it. But how many non-politicians are there in Washington? I don't know.
Well,
or
when,
they don't survive.
I was going to say, when non-politicians go to Washington, what do they come out politicians?
Yeah. And a lot of them go there again. They go there when they're not rich and they leave rich. It's like, okay, how do they do that?
I don't know. So now we've got Apple, which is one of the most innovative, successful companies out there, and our government's going after it because
it's
too
successful.
It
That's the mindset.
It doesn't have anything better.
It's like they got money to give up, right? We can, you know, get something on them because no one's up to any good. The politician always thinks that because why? How they know that? Because they're up to no good, so they project.
Raining on our parade again.
Yeah.
So now we have.
Sorry, when is the new iPad coming up?
The new iPad.
Usually, it's what?
I think it's out.
Oh.
I think it's available the 16th or something.
Okay.
I think that was the date. You can go into stores and buy it and pre-order it.
I wish I knew what to tell you about what's new. I know it's a clearer, crisper screen, this and that. It's faster and a lot faster, actually, when it comes to movies as well. A lot faster, right.
This is why, I mean, this particular problem just reminds us over and over again, we need to get someone into office, in any political office that we can, at any level of government all around the world, people who are ready to peel back the layers of this huge regulatory tax burden onion has been put on us, because again, we're not in a context of capitalism, nothing like it at all.
Nowhere.
And in order to get us closer to a free market with true competition, we have
anti-capitalistic politicians in power.
We need to repeal piece by piece the whole behemoth. So I'm sorry, we now have a very yucky story to talk about. This is from the Daily Mail in the UK, this story, and it describes what is now happening in Iraq.
In the, you know, liberated Iraq, right?
Yeah, Iraq that we fought for under Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Enlightened Iraq.
So that they can have a democratic government and be themselves and not be oppressed by Saddam Hussein.
They were allowed to have Sharia law and Islam into their constitutions, and this is the result of that.
Here's the story. It says, stoned to death for being an emo.
Emotional.
90 Iraqi students killed for having, quote, strange hair and tight clothes, unquote. Says youngster, this is again from the Daily Mail, UK, and it's published on March 10th. It says youngsters in Iraq are being stoned to death for having haircuts and wearing clothes that emulate the so-called emo style, popular among Western teenagers.
And that's the point. It's not about emo. They have no idea what emo is, these killers. They know what Western, you know, what Western look is. So that's why they kill them, I think.
Right. At least 14 youths were killed in Baghdad. They're talking about at least 90 to 100 overall.
They're butchering these kids because they look non-Muslim.
And it says militants in Shia neighborhoods, where I guess Sharia, it's the Shia sect of
Iraqis, Iranians, a lot of them, yeah.
Okay.
Are Shia.
Militants in the Shia neighborhoods where the stonings have taken place circulated lists yesterday naming more youths that are targeted to be killed if they do not change the way they dress.
And you know what? In Saudi Arabia, they have this, I mean, probably countrywide gang called the Matawa. They're self-appointed moral enforcers. And here they call them the moral police.
The moral police, yeah.
And the government more or less turns a blind eye and says, okay, well, we can't argue against them. They're pushing God's law, so that's it.
Iraq's leading Shia clerics have condemned the stonings.
Blah.
Yeah, a lot
yes,
of this.
Yes, publicly to us. To us, they're doing that.
So anyway, so what they do is you've got groups of armed men dressed in civilian clothing who lead dozens of these teenagers to secluded areas, stone them to death, and then dispose of their bodies in garbage dumpsters across the capital. According to activists.
You know, I read a lot about all this stuff, and still it has a power to shock. I mean, this is a 90 to 100 young kids butchered for this. And I have two cartoons on my blog about it if you want to check it out, falsen.blogspot.com, on this.
On this exact issue. It says, Iraq's moral police was granted approval by the Ministry of Education to enter Baghdad schools and pinpoint students with such appearances, according to the Interior Ministry's statement. I guess supposedly they weren't supposed to kill them.
Right.
They were just going to try to convince them not to dress this way because it's horrible.
They have no moral argument against these people killing them. They don't.
No.
That's why they allow them to do it.
And
when it hit the Western news, they said, oh, we disagree with it. That's it.
Yeah. The exact death toll remains unclear, but they're saying that the current figure ranges between 90 and 100.
That means probably a few hundred, probably.
This is and they have different pictures within the article,
yeah.
But if they have a Western hairstyle, they wear American tight pants and stuff, they are targets. Photos of the victims were released on Facebook, causing panic and fear among the Iraqi students. And then they talk about, you know, what is emo, and the people in Iraq, the authorities in Iraq, are, you know, apparently afraid that it's ruining their culture, and this is why they're doing
Islam's not ruining the culture, but bad haircuts are.
Yes, emo haircuts. So here we did, you know, we went to Iraq, we were there for how many years? We won.
A decade.
You know,
6,000, I think, Americans killed, I think. For what?
And this is the kind of thing that they're doing. You're stoned to death because you choose to have a particular hairstyle and wear certain types of clothes.
My first response, I tweeted this, I said, you know, how can you win the hearts and minds of those who have neither? And that's the point. I mean, it's like a Pigman would say, I just tweeted actually, you go win their hearts, I'll go break their hearts. And that's what you got to do. I don't know, this is on us. I mean, these kind of killings are on us. If we took care of business, we went into Iraq, made sure that Sharia law and Islam were not anywhere near their constitution, and enforced that, things like this probably wouldn't happen because they would pay a price for it.
Well, and don't you see that this would probably happen in any of the other countries
that
were
of course,
part of the so-called Arab Spring?
No doubt about it. this will be a new trend probably, to kill these individuals who look Western. And again, it's not about emon. That's just the word that this, you know, we always project. This is an English paper. They're projecting this idea that it's emo.
Mm-hmm.
They look Western. And that's the only thing that the Muslims who are butchering them think. They say, oh, they don't look like Muslims, so kill them.
Here's a statement from Iraq's moral police. It says, the emo phenomenon or devil worshipping is being followed by the moral police who have the approval to eliminate the phenomenon.
Eliminate is an operative word.
Yeah, eliminate the phenomenon as soon as possible, since it's detrimentally affecting the society and becoming a danger. But it's not detrimentally affecting the society or becoming a danger to stone to death 100
kids.
No, that's
not the problem.
Right?
Wearing tight jeans and having messy hair. That will bring down the entire culture.
Right.
Butchering them is a good thing. It's a moral thing.
They wear strange tight clothes and have pictures on them, such as skulls, and use stationery that are shaped as skulls. They also wear rings on their noses and tongues and do other strange activities.
Strange activities.
Yeah.
Meaning they don't go to mosque, maybe.
Imagine that. Horrible. So I think that's some of the worst that I've ever heard.
Yes,
stoned to death for the clothes that you
100
wear.
100 kids so far, on record at least. I mean, again, that probably means that there's a few hundred, at least, if not more. And this is a new thing that's happened there.
So it makes you wonder what's going to happen in Afghanistan once we leave.
And in Egypt,
I assume we're going to leave Afghanistan soon. I hope we're going to leave Afghanistan soon after the story that we saw today.
Were we ever there? I mean, that's the point. Iraq is behaving as if we were never there. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Japan and Germany were flipped completely.
Transformed.
Completely civilized. They were forced to be. They had Japan had a nuclear enlightenment, Germany by force. Iraq basically said, you can be whatever you want. You want to butcher? I mean, whatever. We'll just come and pretend that we did something here. Because American people want us to do something after 9/11. So therefore, we will look like we actually are going to war. We have not gone to war yet, post 9/11.
Ominously, at the end of this article, I just wanted to add one more thing. They said, the moral police said that they're having a hard time because they don't have enough women on the force, because they want to carry on the investigation more accurately, since the emo phenomenon is more popular among girls between the ages of 14 and 18.
So that's what's getting them.
They'd like to stone the girls to death too, but they can't get into the schools because they don't have enough
and
women
to
get into
the schools. And also the boys who don't look with full beards look feminine, so that's why they go after them as well. If they don't have the full beards, well, they're not really men anyway. I don't know. This is just
they have black spiky hair. How dare them?
And they wear sunglasses. And again, they look Western. They look non-Muslim. That's why they're being hunted. That's the only reason.
And I mean, you know, suppose you don't like the trend. Okay, that's fine. You don't like it, but
butcher them.
Hello.
This is the response. And again, what will Obama say about this? Nothing.
Right.
Nothing. What would Bush? You know, Bush ran. I mean, he knows. You know, he won't show his face. They say it's because he has respect. No, he won't show his face. Imagine the shame he feels post 9/11. What he's done. How many Americans were murdered because of him? You know, one of his rules in Iraq was go house to house, you know, kick down the doors, whatever. We've got to make sure that we avoid civilians. There's this term I have. It's called guilty civilians, and the Middle East is full of them. Full of them. Not that we got to go hunt every single one down, but, you know, where terrorists are, there are civilians there. And if they know the terrorists are there, they're fine with that. Well, you know.
If they harbor terrorists,
they're going to have to pay the price for it.
Then that's no good. But the point is that it's a poison culture that we have enabled completely by allowing them to have Sharia elements in their
And that's Bush's fault, you know, the hardcore, you know, Republican.
Right. The Bush administration.
Yes. Right? Again, you know, what's the difference? I don't know. Obama's worse than Bush, maybe, on some levels, yeah.
So maybe we should finish this, I guess, on a slightly lighter note. We've got a few minutes to talk here. I don't know if we have anybody.
People writing about, yeah.
What are we?
Nobody's on.
What are they talking about?
This.
Capitalism, something about. Imagine nuking someone and then being friends with them later. That's what America did when we had moral conviction. That's true.
We went there. We said, okay, look, you're going to join the civilized world. And we're going to teach you how to be civilized. And look what happens.
The comment I was going to make about Japan is that they tended to adopt Western culture and ideas so much that now they're in the situation where they're avoiding the nuclear power.
Well, Germany as well, to the point where they were so guilty, they felt so guilty that they allowed, literally, this is no joke, little pre-9/11, they allowed open terrorist Muslim groups to operate in Germany. This is no joke. They knew what they were, it was what it was, and they have to accept it, and that's it. And I have it in my notes after 9/11. I forgot what name of the group was, but they knew this. And after 9/11, I think they maybe had a change of mind. But that's how pacifistic they become post, you know, World War II. They said, okay, we're going to have to almost kill ourselves, man. I don't know, in order to rid themselves of the guilt that they felt.
Let me talk just for a minute about a story that someone posted on my wall on Facebook and that I looked into and seems to not have a lot to it. There is yet another round of Obama birth certificate questioning. What is the name of the sheriff in Arizona?
Arpaio.
Arpaio?
Arpaio, I don't know.
So Drudge Report is making a big deal out of it. And
it
have
could
all
be
these...
a big deal. I mean, the fact is this. This guy...
Well, I looked at it. Let me tell you.
Wait, what I'm saying is... No, but what I'm saying is I don't trust anything comes out of the guy's mouth. Zero. Who knows what the hell he is? And that's not the major... fact is we got to get him out. That's the most important thing. But go on.
Yeah, so the whole point is they're starting this whole new birth certificate thing. They have this six-part video describing what are the problems. And it comes down to, and I've talked to a number of tech people, and of course there was also a little bit of a logic discussion. That
he was born on Earth. I mean, we do know that.
We know he was born on Earth.
I have a cartoon
Earth.
Called Earth Certificate. Go on.
Yeah. The so-called problems with the birth certificate are all basically explainable via various uses of technology and things like that. So it's, again, probably another barking up the wrong tree right. In terms of actually showing a problem. Then the next question would be, even if you could show that there was a problem with the birth certificate, how far would that get you today?
Yeah.
If you told me that if we figured out this birth certificate thing, that they would completely invalidate Obamacare,
right.
That it would be gone.
Of course not.
Because then
even some Republicans are on board with it.
Then maybe it would be worth it because I don't know. I don't know if Obamacare could have been passed at any other time except for that one moment when they shoved it through against our will. It's disgusting.
And when they had the House and they had the Senate and they had every number,
But this is never going to get us that anyway.
And again, it
seems to be a bunch of barking up
again,
the wrong
tree
again.
Because of Bush's horrific presidency, that's why they had the House. That's why they had the Senate. That's why they had Obama. So if you want to blame, ultimately, I mean, you go back there when a guy did not do what he was supposed to do, Bush.
People are talking in there about who's going to win the nomination. It looks like it's going to be Romney. I don't know if Romney's going to be any better than anybody else.
He will be less destructive than Obama, maybe. And that's it.
All I know is Gingrich is pledging not to jump out of the race, even if he loses in the South. But I hear he's got a pretty good chance to do some winning in the South.
I hope he challenges him. I just hope he challenges him. Makes him, you know, makes him bloody enough where Romney will have to make some promises on record.
And keep the race alive enough for a potential broker convention to see
Absolutely.
If somebody with some brains and some charisma can.
And then the Azimari Republic, who would you want? Say, well, that doesn't exist yet, but let's, you know. You.
Yeah.
That's it. Go.
I'm just going to go run right now. That'll be perfect because I've got nothing better to do.
That's it.
And everybody knows me. Ha, ha, ha. No.
Okay, me.
You?
Here I go.
Okay.
That's it.
Yeah. You'll be very
popular. Boston.
You'd be very popular.
I'll say, look at my work, and that's all you need to know.
You'd be very popular. One other topic is a little more fun. Jeremy Lin.
I don't know. He's playing pretty well, but the Knicks, I don't know. They're just not playing.
He's still a success story?
Yeah, to an extent. He's still playing well. I mean, not as well as before, but Carmelo Anthony, his teammate, since he came back, they've been as mediocre as can be. He's an excellent player, but he's, I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's
and sad. Then what about any racism against Jeremy Lin?
No, well, some comments. One commentator said he's politically correct. It's like, Jeremy Lin, the human being, is politically correct. The idea that we're supposed to like him is politically correct. Whatever. He actually had a great seven-game run, 7-0. Carmelo Anthony comes back, started losing a few games here and there. I'm not going to blame him outright, but the chemistry clearly has suffered since Carmelo Anthony and the whole team came back. And it's sad because I want the Knicks to be, you know, I mean, coming from back east, I mean, I want them to be successful, and they ought to be. It's New York City. That doesn't make sense that a New York City, you know, team would be as mediocre as they've been for the last decade.
Lakers beat Celtics?
Lakers beat Celtics.
So you're happy today?
Personally, I would love to see the Lakers and New York in the finals again and again and again. That would be ideal. As a basketball fan, you know, that would be ideal.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, who hung out today and discussed all of our various topics. And we see some discussion is still going on into the chat room. People are sad that the Knicks are irrelevant.
Yeah.
Robert in New York City would like the Knicks to be relevant again.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's not happening. During the week, you can keep up with me at my blog at don'tletitgo.com. There's going to be some blog posts there at some point for you all to read. I promise. Then you can find me on Twitter, Amy Peekoff on Twitter. And there's the Don't Let It Go Unheard on page on Facebook. And you can follow this show on Blog Talk Radio just by clicking the little follow button if you're on the page where that button exists.
Sure, the IRAM button as well.
Finally, if you do enjoy the show, do spread the word. Tell your friends. We operate on word of mouth, and my mouth is just not that big.
Facebook, Twitter, tweet it, Facebook it, whatever.
So thank you, everyone.
Thanks,
guys,
everyone.
Have a good evening, and we will talk to you next week.